Trofinco's Valor Program for veteran entrepreneurs is especially tailored to support veterans in transitioning to business ownership with dedicated financial solutions and resources. For traveling entrepreneurs, the program offers flexibility and support in funding, critical for those exploring new markets. Business owners will find the personalized approach and understanding of veteran needs invaluable for expanding operations or starting new ventures. Empower your entrepreneurial journey with the Valor Program and turn your business vision into reality. New U-Life Somaderm Gel. Travelers and business owners can benefit from enhanced energy levels and improved sleep quality. Crucial for adjusting to new time zones and maintaining peak performance during business operations. Entrepreneurs will appreciate the potential anti-aging effects, supporting a dynamic, youthful appearance vital for first impressions. Click here now to revitalize your body's natural rhythms and present your best self in every meeting and adventure.
Welcome to the Sales Platoon Podcast, where strategy meets storytelling, right at the crossroads of the battlefield and the business front. We'll bring you tactics, triumphs, and truths from the trenches of sales. Here's your host, John Rankin.
Welcome to the Sales Platoon Podcast, where strategy meets storytelling, and we're right at the crossroads of the battlefield and business front. I'm your host, John Rankin. I'm bringing you all the tactics and truths from the trenches of sales. And in today's episode, we're going to be decoding the transition from service to success with Mike Wickham. How you doing, man?
Hey, how's everybody?
Good. Tell us a little bit about, you know, you, what you did in the military, and when you served.
My standard joke is I was in the Army so long ago, we were still throwing rocks at each other. I'm an Air Force brat from San Antonio, Texas. My dad was an NCO in the Air Force, and he was in the intelligence branch. They call it the security service. And then he had plans for me to go to the Air Force Academy, become a jet jockey. And I ended up going to West Point and became an artillery officer. And I served from 78 to 83. And was stationed over in West Germany, did a couple of schools here on CONUS. My particular unit was a tube artillery unit. We had nuke weapons capable. It was an 8-inch unit. So part of my time, I was a nuke weapons officer. And I was a unit commander for 2 years of my time over in Europe. I was a unit commander. And then I went back to Fort Sill to the advanced course. And when I wanted to go be a foreign area officer and go to the Russian program, the Army wanted me to go recruit people in East LA. So I decided to get out and made the transition into the civilian world. And it's fine. I mean, everything worked out well. I had a great career for about 20 years of international business all over the world. Had a great opportunity to travel quite a bit and do a lot of different things. So I'd be happy to get into more detail on that as we go through this discussion.
Yeah. So there's two things there, you know, that I want to kind of focus on. So first, because you were in West Point, that West Point network, it's changed quite a bit since you were there. When you were there, did they focus on the West Point network the way they do now?
Not officially. I mean, you know, the whole ring knocker thing of you have a brotherhood of people that will help you throughout your careers, all that. I mean, some of my commanders were academy grads when I was in the service, and, you know, most were not because they don't really, you know, the numbers of people that commission out of non-academy sources is a lot greater than what comes out of the academy.
Yeah.
And so I did happen to have a few guys that were academy grads that were ahead of me. And then I served with several people that were academy grads in my unit. And so a couple of my classmates were there with me, and then other guys that were ahead of us. But once I got out of the service, I've actually tapped into the network quite a bit, and it's been very helpful on a lot of different fronts, personal and professional. And as I say, as we walk through my career, my transition, one of the steps that took place was that what started me off in a 20-year international business career was a phone call from a classmate saying, there's an opportunity available for you. Let me back up a second. I've traveled ever since I was 4 years old. I grew up in Asia. My dad was Air Force. We went back and forth to Asia all the time. So I've always had a travel bug. Yeah, and what happened was I even at the academy, I was sent to Belgium on an exchange with the Belgian Military Academy. And then I was sent to Africa to do, it was called Crossroads Africa, but it was essentially like Peace Corps work. And so I was always going somewhere. And so my my classmates used to refer to me as the gypsy because I was never in the same place for very long. And so when I got out of the service, one of my classmates called me and he says, you know, you've been the gypsy as far as long as I've known you. So, you know, there's a job in the international relations department at MCI International, which is now Sprint or T-Mobile, or it's a long transition of various companies through acquisition.
Whatever it is now.
At the time, right. At the time, it was MCI International, and they had an opening for an international position. And that started me off on doing things on an international basis for something close to 25 years. And and it was all because a buddy of mine happened to work for them in a different capacity. And he knew these guys in the international department and said, I got a perfect candidate for you. So I called my eventual boss on a Friday. They flew me up to I was in Oklahoma at the time, and they flew me up to New York on a Monday. And I got a job offer on Wednesday. And 2 weeks later, I was up in New York working for MCI for 3 years. And so it all happened because of a military connection that, you know, that helped me get my foot in the door.
This is one thing I've noticed about West Point. So I was I don't know what you guys call it, but basically I was a guest instructor there for 4 years. I would come up for just 1 3-week period of time and then teach the cadets, right? And throughout my time, one of my really good friends, General Scott Brower, was a West Point grad, Jay Powers, West Point grad, Colonel Powers. And I've noticed that in West Point, whether it's done intentionally, it's more intentional now than probably when you were there, but they really do teach, or at least have this idea of keeping that networking going even after you leave West Point, to the point to where now, even in the business world, oh, it's the West Point kind of gang, right? Like there's this idea, and I don't know if the Naval Academy and the Air Force Academy do it or the Citadel does it, but West Point is actually known in the civilian world for you guys' ability to network with each other and get stuff done. And it is such an important lesson, not just for you guys, but everybody in the military to start developing that network of people that you served with or served around in order to get stuff done when you become a civilian. So when you were there, did you ever think that that's kind of how it would play out, or is that just all accidental?
I mean, I knew that there was a quote unquote fraternity. I mean, we belong to the largest fraternity in college because it's 4,000 people at a time. And so I knew that there was going to be this heritage from the Academy grads. And I saw that because you cycle through the same sorts of assignments. You come back to the Academy to teach if that's your path. And then when you get out into the business world, you keep in touch with these guys formally and informally, through reunions, through networking groups, and just through personal contact. And, you know, like most recently I've lived in Houston and now in San Antonio. And there's two things. There's the West Point Association in each of the cities, and then there's the Service Academy Association in each of the cities. So even though we tease one another all the time about the different service academies, we all get together as academy graduates and trade stories, help one another, you know, give advice, do whatever. And so it's not just the West Point guys, it's all academies. And then in addition to that, you know, we're very happy to have other people that are just business associates to come in and join in the festivities, because we, you know, we have a lot of stuff going on. And it's in each of the cities, each of the major cities will have organizations similar to that. And it's not just the academies. I mean, like in Houston is probably the most networked city in the country that I've ever been to. They have a networking group for every slice of life. And so you can go there with a personal or a professional interest, find a group of like-minded people, and really get involved with the community there in Houston. And so, you know, you leverage that in addition to the academy associations. And you're right, people that are academy graduates do get looked at differently because it carries that reputation. And so in some sense, it lets you maybe take a step ahead of the next guy, but it doesn't necessarily prove that you're going to be successful simply because it's what you bring to the table in the end.
Yeah.
But that pedigree, you know, it's the same with Ivy League schools. It's the same with each major university within the state. In Texas, it's University of Texas and then A&M. In, you know, Michigan, it's U of M and it's Michigan State, that type of thing.
Right.
So there's always some kind of a deference made to certain institutions that maybe are in your educational pedigree. And then, but the bottom line is, what do you bring to the party? Do you have the enthusiasm, the drive, the the great ideas, you know, the discipline to do the things necessary to be successful in business or in a nonprofit or whatever it is you're getting involved in.
Sure. Now, it's pretty interesting. So you go from being a field artillery guy to an international business. How does that transition in your mind? How did that work? Well, actually, let me back up 1 second, because you served in a period of time where there were no resources for anybody.
Yeah. Right?
So maybe West Point did something for guys getting out of the military, but because I know, because I served in the 90s, there was nothing for us. Talk about your transition and what you went through getting out.
Well, first of all, it was a difficult decision because my whole family, top to bottom, were military people, all branches of service. And so, and like I say, my dad was Air Force. His brothers were Air Force. One of my mom's brothers were Marine Corps, Navy, and Air Force. And so it was ingrained in me that when I got out of high school, yeah, I wanted to go to college, and I didn't want my parents paying for college. So I ended up going to West Point. And upon graduation, I just, in my mind, I had, you know, a 20-year career laid out in front of me. Mm-hmm. And at the end of my command, and when I went back to the advanced course, what ended up happening, what I found out is I wanted to be a Russian defense analyst. I wanted to go to Russian school, language school at Monterey, and then go to get a master's degree and then go on assignment someplace doing that function. And the reason I did that as a secondary is because that's what I really wanted to do in the Army. But I figured if I went into the intelligence branch, everybody's going to be a foreign area officer, so there's going to be a lot more competition. And so as an artillery officer with a secondary, that might give me a better chance to get that path. And I thought I'd qualified. I speak a couple of foreign languages. I did a lot of liaison work when I was in Europe. I mean, my battalion commander thought I was on loan to him because I was getting sent out so much to do French translation for various people. And so, I mean, right during one AGI, I was the battalion adjutant, and I get a phone call at 9 o'clock that morning, and some guy says, "Where the hell are you?" And I said, "Well, who the hell is this?" And I was a second lieutenant or first lieutenant at the time. And the guy goes, "This is Colonel so-and-so from 5th Corps headquarters. You were supposed to be up here for the briefing." I said, "What briefing? I don't know what you're talking about." He says, "You're the translator, the French translator for this NATO exercise that's going on for the next 3 weeks." I said, "Sir, we're right in the middle of an AGI." And I said, I'm the S1. And so you got to talk to my boss. And so I transferred him over to my battalion commander. 5 minutes later, my battalion commander comes down and says, "Pack a bag, Mike, you're out." And I took off and left. And so that went on constantly for like 6 or 8 months. And he said, "You're on loan to me rather than me being on loan to someplace else." So anyway, when I went back to the advanced course, I had in my head, you know, what the DA told me when I was a second lieutenant, brand new, they said, "Manage your own career." I said, okay. So then when I finished my long tour overseas, I had my command, all that stuff. I was punching all the tickets. I said, "Well, here's what I want to do. I want to be a foreign area officer. I want to go to the Russian program. Speak two languages, have a background in traveling all over the place, fit in anywhere, you know, I'm the guy." Well, what happened was I hit the end of the fiscal cycle, and the guys in Washington were going like, "We have 2 stacks, jobs and people, and we're going to have to put these together. For me to get a good OER, I've got to get this cleaned up before I can open up the stuff for the next year."
Right.
And it turns out they gave all of us, all of the guys who were rotating about the same time I was, regardless of branch, were getting offered the same crappy jobs. And so a buddy of mine who was 1 cycle behind me, who hardly spoke English, I don't know that he could write his name 3 times in a row, he got the Russian program because he was 6 months later than me and got into the new fiscal cycle. And I thought, that is just not right. So I got annoyed. And I said, they said, "We can't send you the Russian thing because you're a West Point guy. That's a 7-year program. It'll take you out of consideration for 05 command." I said, "Let me worry about that." And they said, "Well, you speak French. We'll send you to Delta. We'll send you to Sub-Saharan Africa." I said, "I've been to Africa. Don't want to go back." Then they said, "You speak French. We'll send you to Arabic. You can go to the Middle East, be an advisor." Well, had I known what today looks like, probably been a good thing for me to be an Arabic speaker. Yeah. But I said, "No, I have a young family. I don't want to go to the Middle East on an isolated tour." And then they said, "Well, last offer. We'll send you back to, we'll send you the DLI for German. Send you back to Germany. You'll be a G5. And I said, "G5, that's a liaison officer. In my mind, that's a glorified travel agent and escort service. I don't want to do that either." So I said, I'm out. I got out. So I spent my last 30 days on active duty getting my butt chewed by every general officer at Fort Sill. And then I left. And that was, you know, the transition was just that. It was just, there was a group of people in corporate America that had these interview sessions in major cities, Denver, Dallas, whatever. And it was from Honeywell, Motorola, Texas Instruments, all the major companies at the time. They would have these job fairs in these major cities. And so like 2 days in a row, a buddy of mine and I drove from Lawton, Oklahoma down to Dallas to interview with different companies. And he got a job with, like Motorola, and I got a job with an industrial chemical company called Nalco, just to have a job when I got out of the service. It was industrial chemicals in a sales position up in Tulsa. And so it gave me the opportunity to make the transition without being unemployed. And so I took the job, and then 6 months later, I got a call from that buddy of mine up in New York about the international job. And then that kicked off a much bigger opportunity. But it was forcing the issue.
I mean, to go from field artillery, and obviously you're super intelligent, multiple languages, to go from all of that to sales, and even though it was a short stint, I mean, had you ever done sales before?
Sales. What is sales? Every transaction, every interaction is a sale.
Yeah.
And I've always had an outgoing personality. It's always been easy for me to talk to people. And so in my mind, it was nothing more than tell me what it is you want me to sell, product or service. And then as long as I understand it enough to be able to then talk to somebody about it, I never had really an issue with it. It was never something I was intimidated by, because I like talking to people.
Yeah. Yeah. So you get this call, you go to MCI, that's 3 years. Where do you go after that? I mean, you have 25 years and international business.
I got into that. And what it is MCI was trying to break into the international telephone market. And so my job was to go to all, and my territory started off in the Caribbean and ended up in Latin America. And while I was managing the Caribbean, I was the most hated man in the office, because all the other guys were going to Bangladesh and sub-Saharan Africa, and I was going to the Bahamas. So, it was great. And my answer to them was, somebody has to do it better me than you. So we were taking their services and trying to sell it to government entities, because it was all they did was international telephone stuff. So there was no like product on a consumer level. It was all government to government. So I was involved in negotiating with governments to what they call proportionate return. So we send you X amount of traffic, you send us a similar percentage back the other way. And that went on for 3 years in different countries. I was wandering all of these different countries, meeting all the different government agencies. And then after I left MCI, I went to work for a telephone manufacturer that made, if you saw the movie Wall Street with Charlie Sheen and Michael Douglas, on the trading floor, those big phones that they had, the company I worked for made those phones. We actually provided them to the set. And I had the international responsibility outside of London. We had an office in London, and I had everything else, taking these phone systems and selling them to the financial community. So we were selling them to Bear Stearns, American Express, Chase Manhattan, all the big brokerage houses around the world. And I managed major customers, major multinationals, as well as people in country that would be our representatives. So I was the New York suit that would come and make sure that Mitsubishi Electric was doing everything right for us in Japan. And so, and then from there, I ended up working for AT&T. And about 10 years I was working for AT&T. It was a small division of AT&T at the time. It was $300 million. And so, they're what they call their long lines division, which was their long distance telephone division here in the domestic U.S., was tens of billions of dollars. And we had a $300 million division in New Jersey. And it was basically an experimental division. Everything we do today, cell phones, voice over the internet, e-commerce, we test drove all that. And what they asked me to do was to say, take this product or service, identify a market internationally where we could test drive it, identify a company that can sell service and support that product, and then in 18 months, bring us back some positive revenue. And so I did that over and over again in Asia and Latin America and Europe. And that for 10 years, I did that type of a thing for this division. Okay. And then when I left AT&T, I went to work for a couple of entrepreneurial firms in the New York City area. One, and it's always technology or telecommunications is that whole period of time. And I worked for a couple of different companies. I got hired by the next company because of all my AT&T contacts and my international contacts. It was a company called Net2Phone, which was a voice over the internet. And it was parent company was IDT. And I think they're still around. But what they wanted to do was take their new product and take it to 25 countries abroad and do an IPO. And so because of all my AT&T contacts, they hired me to go in 6 months' time, get it into place in a dozen countries in Asia, Latin America, and Europe. So I was bouncing around doing that, trying to negotiate deals to where we could install this product in these various countries. And then they, you know, the IPO hit, and I was a paper millionaire for about, you know, 5 minutes. And then when the bill came due for all the stuff that I'd put in place, they didn't want to pay the bill.
Oh, and no.
So I said, you had me go out there with all of my personal contacts and my reputation, and now you're going to stiff these guys on the bill. And the answer was, well, have them sue us. And I was like, I'm out. I got to get out of here. There's no way I can work like that.
Yeah.
And so I left there and I worked for a couple of other entrepreneurial firms. And then I ended up, it's a long history of stuff. I started working for a software development company making enterprise level mobile applications. And then I got into, you know, and that was really interesting because it was a virtual company. We had developers in international places in Malta, in Germany, in Pakistan. And then we had like an administrative office here in Texas, in Austin and in San Antonio, or in Houston, rather. I've touched a lot of different market segments, a lot of different technology, telecommunications companies at different levels, manufacturing.
Yeah. With great locations, by the way.
Yeah. It was, yeah.
Come on, man.
Yeah.
The Bahamas. Nice.
Yeah, I have no complaints about the places I've been.
Right.
But so in all those cases, you get back to the sales and transition. In all those cases, what was important is, you know, making the connection, being able to express yourself, understand your product, say things confidently, and back up what you're saying. And so in most cases, people that get into a sales function, they go at it, I'm going to say like a car salesman. They go at it as if they have to hustle somebody. They have to keep information back from people. And I've always felt like that's really not the formula. I mean, yeah, you can get some successes that way, but they're going to bounce on you. And so my approach, and part of it is the West Point pedigree of, you know, the duty on our country is to be legitimate with people, to be forthright, and to be knowledgeable. And, you know, when I walk into a sales situation, I tend to come across as somebody who, one, knows what he's talking about, and two, you know, can be trusted in what he's saying. And so that's always given me a level of a success that says, you know, people want to talk to me, people want to do business with me because they feel like I've got some solid footing under me. And
Root Brands Wellness's Zero In offers a competitive edge over other nootropics like Joe Rogan's Alpha Brain by focusing on natural gut health axis optimization, providing clearer cognitive function and sustained attention without artificial stimulants. Travelers will benefit from enhanced mental clarity during long journeys, while entrepreneurs and business owners can leverage improved focus for strategic planning and execution. Elevate your mental game beyond conventional limits and outperform your competition with Zero In today.
Huh. So where are you now? Talk to me about the company you're at now, what you do now. And then I'm going to kind of, because there's a couple of things that you said that I want to highlight for the kids that are listening. I say kids because we're older, but.
Right.
Yeah.
Right now I'm in San Antonio. For a period of time, I was doing some just business consulting on my own. I figured I'd built enough businesses for other companies. Why don't I help, you know, small business? And I used to tease people and say, I'm the guy you bring in when I'm the guy you bring in to fire your brother-in-law because he's the wrong accountant for the company. What I always tell people is, you know, ideas and enthusiasm will get you to $2 million in revenue, but to go to 5 or 10 takes a different set of talent. And I'm the guy that would come in and tell you, okay, what do you need to get from 2 to 5 to 10 and help companies do that? And then I was toying with the idea of retiring because I'm 67 now. And I was toying with the idea of retiring, and I thought, you know, I just have too much energy and I just like getting out there. So what's the point? You know, keep doing it until it's no fun anymore. And I knew this guy in town here who runs he's had this managed services company, this IT services company since he was in high school. So 25 years now, he's in his late 40s and he's known each other for about 5 years. And he's been bugging me for like 3 years. He says, come join me, you know, gotta help me. And so back in November, I decided let's just give it a ride because I didn't really want something that had a big title and big responsibility at this point in my life. I want to just relax and enjoy myself. So I've joined this company called SD Tech. and it's here in San Antonio. We serve primarily the greater San Antonio metro area, which kind of big circle around Austin and San Antonio, but they have customers scattered around the country. So when there's an account here that might have satellite offices in Denver and Los Angeles and New York, then we'll support that as well. But generally speaking, the business is in and around the greater San Antonio area. And then by extension, Dallas and Houston and other places in Texas. What we do is everything related to technology for small business. The focus is going to be on companies that are 5 to 100 employees that probably don't have someone who can support their IT network, or they just have somebody who makes sure the printers are working, and that's about the extent of their expertise. So we'll step in and help those people. We don't want to be working for Lockheed Martin or Valero, because you know, that's just too big of an account.
Yep.
And San Antonio is a small to medium sized business city. It's changing, but right now it's a small to medium sized business city. So it's a real nice sweet spot for what we do. And we do everything from card access doors, you know, those electric doors, and that could be an external door or even an internal door to a laboratory or to a secure area. And then we do surveillance cameras and then everything related to the computers. So from the hardware to the networking to the software and the cloud services and cybersecurity and all that stuff.
Wow, dude. Dang. Okay.
It's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. So this is a great conversation because it's not just our students that are listening, but there's going to be other people. This podcast goes out to a ton of people. Talk to me about that scaling. I'm a business. I've hit 7 figures. And you said it's their enthusiasm, their energy, kind of their vision that gets them to 1 or 2 million. But it takes something completely different to hit 5 or 10. What is that?
Well, it's a number of things. Let's assume you're building a product, you know, a heart, something you can touch. Well, then it becomes an issue of when you have to scale. One, you have to get the money to scale. So you've got to have some sort of a banking relationship or venture capital or whatever, some sort of a funding source. And then you have to find a source that's going to make the product for you. And the biggest problem with that is quality control. Because once you start making things at scale, you probably can't do it locally. You'll have to go find some manufacturing facility somewhere, whether that's stateside or whether that's overseas. And you know, and one of the things we learned in the software development piece is that even though Pakistan or Malta, the guys spoke English, but the problem is when we'd send specs to them, their interpretation of the spec is a lot different than what we thought. Yeah. And so it took several iterations to get it to the point where, you know, whatever we were asking them to do would get to where we needed it to be. And it's the same when you're building something, a piece of hardware that years ago I had to go to Singapore because we were going to do some injection molding and we were going to do some sub-assembly stuff for these telephones. And, you know, I had to go interview all these different companies over there that did injection molding, that did sub-assembly electronics and that sort of thing. And it's very difficult to find the right company that shares not only your vision and your mindset to be able to manufacture at scale. So you need the money, you need to find the right manufacturing source. And then once you do that, you have to come up with the logistics channel that says, how do I get it from the manufacturer either to a holding location or my warehouse or to the customer? And so you need somebody that understands logistics that can do that. And then from a financial side, somebody has to be in your finance team that can understand pricing models and, you know, cost controls and all these different things, because it's easy to say, here's X amount of money to build stuff. But if the per unit cost is too high for your market and you can't price it at $100, you got to price it at 50, you're going to lose money on every item. And so that's why I say people that start with an idea, they can do stuff on a small scale. They need 100 units of this or 500 units of that. But once it gets to the point where you need 100,000 units of something, all these other factors come into play. And if you don't have the expertise to do that and you don't have people around you that know how to do that, then basically you're going to spend the money and you'll be broke in 6 months. Yeah. And that's what happens to a lot of companies that reach that 2 million pinnacle and then they want to go higher and things don't work out because they don't surround themselves with people that understand finance and logistics and they don't have a banking relationship. And they don't have somebody who's an operations guy that can really keep track of the manufacturing side of things. And so it's hard to tell an entrepreneur that I know it's his baby, but you got to get, let the babysitter take it every now and then, because you can't do it all yourself.
Yeah.
And that's the hardest thing. You know, you can explain all this to them. And right now in my job as an internet services guy, the big thing right now is cybersecurity. And, you know, you go into a company or a law firm or a doctor's office and you say, what would it cost you if your business shut down for a day, for a week, for a month? And then you tell them, here's how you can avoid that. And then they just don't take the step. And it's like, well, when it breaks, it's not going to be as easy to fix. If I can get ahead of this, you know, I can protect you.
So there's a company. It's so interesting you bring this up, because I don't think most companies realize how at risk they are. So I have a friend, he owns a cyber company, and he was telling me there's a very large medical company in Nashville, and it has something like, I forget what he said, but it was something like some outlandish 20 penetration attempts a day from China.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And so I think when we think of cyber, we think of like just some teenage kid that's learned how to hack and he's going to steal your emails. But they don't realize that there's nation states like Russia and China going after our businesses. And this is such an important thing. And how much would it cost you if China beat down your door, your cyber door, and like the oil pipelines?
The industry stats are 60% of the hacks are hitting businesses that are under 20 million in revenue. And the reason is because they're the companies that have 5 to 50 people. So therefore, nobody on staff that watches the network. And so they're low hanging fruit. They're easy pickings.
Right.
But when you try to hit Lockheed or when you try to hit Exxon, they have thousands of people on staff that their job is protecting the network. So it's much harder to get into those places, even though the payoff at Sony is much better.
Right.
But the problem is, the easy one is to go after the doctor's office, go after the small manufacturer, go after the, you know, the regional hospital and hit them. And the average ransom is somewhere in, like, I think it's $3 million, something like that.
Jeez.
And in most cases, they only give back about 60% of the data so they can keep you on the hook for the next time.
So I don't know if you saw this article, but, you know, this stuff for me, because I was a grunt, right? Like I'm small entrepreneur grunt. And my buddy was telling me that in Las Vegas, they had come up with a way that they put a cyber attack inside a thermostat inside the fish tank in Las Vegas and stole millions from that casino. And I was just like, you know, what? No, you know, and so I don't think businesses really realize how much at risk they are with that.
Well, and the other problem too is, like, I was in a law firm the other day and they had virtually nothing to secure their network. And I said, you know, you're going to be on the other end of this equation when you get sued because somehow or another you compromised information of your clients.
Ooh.
And they said, well, we're not, that's not a priority right now. We're going to take care of it later. I said, okay, whatever.
Whatever.
Gave you the information. And if you don't want to do anything with it, that's on you.
Yeah.
But the other problem is, a company like that, if they got hacked, their reputation would be so ruined that they would not, you know, they couldn't do any business with anybody.
Yeah.
And it's not a monetary thing. It's just a question of, you've just ruined your reputation. Where do you go to get that back?
Right. Right. You know, so in sales, it's so important to divorce yourself from other people's yes and no, right?
And
throughout this process that you've been talking about, consulting and taking companies from 1 and 2 million to 5 and 10, you've got to do the same thing. Because always you're putting out this information on how to scale, and you've done it for other companies. And here you get this little law firm that's like, whatever.
Well, what I've found is, and this happens over and over again in the last 25, 30 years of business, is that when I go into a situation and I have a compelling case to sell whatever it is I'm representing, and I get turned down, it never bothers me all that much, because I know that at some point I'm going to get a call from these people and they're going to need what I have. And it's happened over and over and over again. And I remember one situation where there was a woman, I can't remember what her business was, but she got really ugly and just really unloaded on me. And I just said, okay, fine. And I walked away. And about 6 months later, she called me back and she says, Mike, this is Mrs. So-and-so. You probably don't remember me. And I said, oh, I remember you. and I just, you know, I didn't bring it up and she didn't bring it up, but she knew that I knew the last time we met was a bad day. And yeah. I just let it go. I said, you know what, how can I help you? What can I do for you now? You know, you had a bad day then. Okay, that's fine. Let's start fresh right now.
Yeah.
And it always happens that way.
Man, it really does. That's such a good point. I had a mentor of mine tell me years ago, and the same what you're sharing now, you can have your right to have your opinions and your feelings, mm-hmm. or you can decide to do business and make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Which one do you want?
Right. Right.
You know, so, and it was that. And so now I no longer post any of my opinions on social media about anything controversial. I was like, man, that's a really good point. I took all that stuff down. So, you know, as we get ready to kind of wrap up here, we have 30, 40 kids in class right now that are learning how to do sales, learning how to do B2B, you know, professional business relationships. Mm-hmm. What are some tips and some things that you, as somebody that's just really performed at such a high level, as they're in their last 3 to 6 months of service now, what are some tips or some things that you would tell them to focus on for the next 3 months, next 6 months? And then what would they do when they first get out? What do you think from your vantage point?
Yeah, I think in sales, the most important thing is being genuine. People can sense if you're genuine or if you're scripted or if you're trying to con them. So you have to be genuine. And you have to take a hard look in the mirror and say, what is my personality? And then have a critique of what's good about it and what's not good about it. Do you make eye contact? Do you smile? Do you sit up? Do you dress properly? All these superficial things. That's the first thing, be genuine. Second thing is, especially if you're talking about guys that are transitioning out of the service and they're young, they're under 25, under 30, whatever they are. And the issue there is you have to, one, be genuine, but secondly, you have to be curious. You don't pitch people anymore. It's not, you know, in my day, when I first got into sales, it was all feature functionality. You know, you did your PowerPoint and it was all, here's what it is and here's what it does for you. Well, now the sales mentality is are you a problem solver? Because your customer is going to have a problem. And the only reason you're sitting in front of them is because you potentially can solve the problem. And so if you go in with a curiosity and you ask the right questions and let them talk, I mean, it's the old adage, the one who talks the most loses. And so if you go into a situation, you ask open-ended questions and get them to talk, they'll reveal so much stuff to you. And consequently, you have to listen to what the answer is so that then you can pivot and bring your expertise into play based on what they just told you. And the last thing is you have to follow up. You have to be, you know, honor the word that you have. If you say you're going to do something on Tuesday, if you say you're going to get them a quote, if you say that it's going to be delivered in 3 weeks, that stuff's got to happen. And over time, you'll develop a reputation as being a reliable person. And that's the most important thing you can be in a sales environment, is a reliable person. People will come back to you. They will refer you to other people. But the biggest thing is the genuineness and your curiosity. You can't come in there and browbeat people with information. They don't want to do that. You got to read people. There's these whole series of matrices that say, okay, if a person is an A personality, a B personality, if someone's a scientist, a hugger or whatever, there's all these different analyses. But what it is you have to read your audience and you have to understand if it's the whole thing of mirroring. If someone sits up in their chair, sit up in your chair. If someone leans forward, lean forward, you know, just mirror their behavior. And that's subconsciously makes them comfortable with you.
Yeah.
And so if you can teach these guys as they're transitioning from being in the military and having that mentality and having that officer, NCO or superior subordinate type of thing, it's very stilted. It's not the way it is in business. Business, you have to go into a situation as an equal. If you walk into a CEO's office, you got to act like a CEO. He doesn't want to deal with underlings. If you walk into a business owner's, you know, you talk to him like a business owner. You got to mirror the situation that you're in. And it takes a little time and it takes a little confidence. And sometimes you got to fake it. But I mean, the thing is, the first part of it is, like I said, being genuine. Understand your personality. Understand how you come across. Understand not only the way you speak, but the way you look and how you come across. And that's, if you can be critical about that and then fix the things that may, some people, you know, ask other people. And if they tell you, you come across kind of brassy or you come across kind of lazy, then you got to fix that. And once you do that, then you're on the path to being able to do these other things that are going to help you be successful in sales.
Awesome. So there's quite a few people that I'm connected with that are transitioning out. They're IT, cyber, being as that's your world. Mm-hmm. What's the best way for them to reach out and contact you?
I'm on LinkedIn. They can look me up on LinkedIn. And I mean, you have my contact information. I'd be happy to share it any way you want to do it. I'll be happy to help anybody.
Great. Man, Mike, thank you so much. That was, I think I'll circle back with you because the scaling conversation is so intriguing to me because we're right now scaling our company. And so there's a lot of wisdom that I think that you could really lend to us in that process. And so super valuable today. Appreciate you spending your time with us. And if you need anything, don't hesitate to reach out to me.
Well, my other byline, my other phrase is don't invite me because I show up. So,
I don't mind.
Thanks a lot, John.
Thanks.
Follow us on Instagram, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Sales Platoon for more updates and veteran success stories. Join us next time as we continue to decode the art of selling through the unique perspectives of those who've served.